Weekday evenings on FM 101.5 and AM 1400, The Patriot. It's 6 o'clock talk with Daryl Wood. Host Daryl Wood brings you the day's news and trending topics as only he can, with a unique blend of conservative opinion, constitutionalism, and thought-provoking analysis. Join the conversation. 6 o'clock talk with Daryl Wood. A daily look at the news in a way you won't hear anywhere else. Tune in to 6 o'clock talk with Daryl Wood on FM 101.5 and AM 1400, The Patriot, or stream at patriotdetroit.com.
You are in what part of the country?
Southwest Colorado.
Wonderful. How are you picking us up?
Oh, I stream you guys on my iPhone every day.
Fantastic.
I am a resident of Sterling Heights, but I frequently come to Southwest Colorado.
I am just thrilled to be hearing from you out there in Colorado. Continue to listen, tune in again, and call at your earliest convenience. Godspeed.
Run to Win with Daryl Wood, Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. on Faith Talk Detroit.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I am your host, Herschel Finn. We've got a show for you today. In this half hour, we're going to do something totally different. The show's going to be totally different than it normally is because there's lots of things going on. In the first half hour of the show, we're going to do a rebroadcast of an interview that we had with Senator Joe Lieberman, who had written a book called With Truth and Justice. At that time, it was a Sphera book and 50 essays. It was written The interview was April 12, 2020, and Joe Lieberman passed away on Wednesday, March the 27th. So in honor of his passing, in memory of Joe, we're going to replay that interview. In the second half of the show, we're going to be speaking with Detroit's own Rabbi David Shapiro, who is on top of being a rabbi, in addition to being a rabbi, is also an expert astronomer. And we're going to be talking about the upcoming solar eclipse and what Judaism has to say about it. If we have time to play music, we'll see. If we have time for some insights into the portion, which this week is the portion of Shmini, which can be found in the book of Leviticus chapter 9 and following, we'll do that. Most likely we'll just end off with a really amazing Hasidic story at the end. So right now what we're going to do is we're going to go straight to Joe Lieberman, and speaking about his, which was from our interview, recorded on April 12th, 2020.
Thank God, Rabbi. I'm good. I hope you are too.
Oh, thank you so much for asking. Okay, so we are in this, what's referred to as the Sephira period. We are counting the days in anxious anticipation from Passover to Shavuos, the holiday of the Pentecost, which will be observed in the middle of May. And you've come out just recently with a compendium of essays that you've written, which 50 essays, 50 days in between. And so tell us about this. What's the impetus behind writing with Liberty and Justice?
Okay. Well, I must say it builds on a book I did about 4 or 5 years ago on Shabbat called The Gift of Rest. And that one had been building in me a long time because Shabbat means so much to me. And I've been asked so many questions about it because it became public during my years in elective office that I wrote the book. And there was a good reception to it from Jewish people and not Jewish people. So I've had another thought, probably a less universally appealing, but I think important nonetheless, which is that Shavuot is the most important, least appreciated of the Jewish holidays. And its meaning, which is, of course, the receiving of the Torah, the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, is a not only a central event in Jewish history, but in world history, because in many ways, the giving of the law on Mount Sinai from God to the children of Israel is the basis of all the legal systems that have followed, certainly the ones in the Western world in rule of law society. So, in other words, to put it another way, Passover, Pesach, is clearly the most observed of the Jewish holidays because everybody likes getting together around the meal, the whole idea of freedom, the liberation from slavery. But it leads to Shavuot, the festival of the receiving of the law, again, one of the least observed, maybe the least observed, and yet they're tied together. One Shavuot gives ultimate meaning to Pesach because, remember, in the Torah, it's very clear that the Israelites are not freed from Egypt just to be free and wander in the desert or even assimilate into Egyptian society as full-fledged Egyptian citizens. They are liberated for a purpose, and it is to go to Mount Sinai to receive the law, the kind of mission statement of the Jewish people, and then go on to the land of Israel. So all that is in the book. It's a way to try to bring people into exactly what you said, Rabbi, the sense of expectation that we feel every day as we count the Omer. Today is Sunday, the 15th day of the Omer, moving steadily toward Har Sinai, toward Mount Sinai. And I divided it into 50 short essays. They're, generally speaking, 2 to 4 pages, easy to read once a day during the counting of the Omer, or at any pace the reader wants. So long answer to your question, but that's how I got to write the book. And I'm very grateful to Hashem that I was able to do it, and I hope it's of a benefit to people who read it.
Okay, so now, did you just like sit down and write 50 essays, or these are things that you had in your mind and over a period of time, and this is the compendium that developed from it?
That's a really good question. So I had the whole idea of the book in mind, and I began to crystallize this idea of 50 short essays, a kind of companion to the counting of the Omer, if people wanted to use it that way. But I must say that the actual construction of the book, I have a collaborator here who was recommended to me by my friend and teacher, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, who's the managing director of the OU Press. And the collaborator is Rabbi Ari Khan, who is a rabbi in Israel. He's on the faculty at Bar-Ilan University. And, you know, we met a few times, both over in Israel and here, to talk about both the organization of the book and of exactly what we wanted to say. And it was a very productive collaboration for me. You know, as obvious when I stated in the book, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a Jewish scholar. I'm a layperson who is devoted to his Judaism and is devoted to the law and the law, the big law that we got on Mount Sinai and the law that I've been involved in all my life as a lawyer, a lawmaker, a legislator, and attorney general, a law enforcer for 6 years here in Connecticut. So, but Rabbi Khan and I were in dialogue in classic kind of Jewish Talmudic dialogue, and it produced the book. But as I say at the beginning, the rabbi informed a lot of what I was doing, helped me to make sure I didn't make mistakes. But really, I wrote it, and I take responsibility for every word in it. None of it is really the responsibility of Rabbi Khan.
Okay, understood. Now, it's published by OU Press and Magid Books from Israel. But I'm thinking and looking over this, the major, the underlying theme seems to be through all 50 essays, the idea of morality and ethics. And I'm wondering, what's your feeling with what's going on now with Washington? And maybe that had something to do with why this liberty with liberty and justice came out now.
So it's quite relevant, really. And in different of the essays, I refer, this is not a political book, but in different of the essays, I make connections to what's happening in our politics. So, for instance, I tell the very moving story from the Talmud, you know, about Rav Yochanan and Rav Lakish, and Rav Lakish, I believe it is, passes away. That they studied together, they learned together, and it's very spirited. One of them dies, and the other one falls into depression, and his students bring another great scholar to learn with him, and he gets very frustrated because the second scholar doesn't argue with him, just supports everything he says. And I say, look, there's not enough of that in our politics today. Nobody listens to the other side, and nobody thinks it's possible that they might learn from the other side. So that's one lesson that comes out of this. Clearly, the other lesson, which runs through Jewish history and Jewish values, Torah and Talmud, is that the higher one goes in any world, in the religious world, in the political world, the higher the standards of accountability. Because if, as in the case of Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, you don't do what is right, or in that case specifically expected by Hashem, by God, the consequences are very serious. They're greater than if somebody, you know, who's just an average citizen doesn't do what he's expected to do. And obviously this is true right up to Moshe Rabbeinu, who was our greatest leader, really for one major transgression, hitting that rock, he is not allowed to enter Eretz Yisrael. So this is all my way of saying that public figures really have a responsibility not only to do what they think is right in terms of policies, but their behavior, their personal behavior, really is part of their leadership. And, you know, I'm not just talking about the president. There are a lot of others in Congress and governor's offices and et cetera, local offices, whose personal behavior hasn't been what it should be, and that has an effect on our society.
So what you're saying is we really should hold accountable the private behavior of all the public figures then, correct, Senator Lieberman?
Yeah.
Okay, so now let me ask.
No, that's true. Look, I was a great supporter and friend of President Clinton when that whole business occurred with Monica Lewinsky. I was really hurt by it and perplexed by it and embarrassed by it. And ultimately, I got up and made a speech on the floor of the Senate, which called on President Clinton, who was my friend. I have known him since the early 70s, and he was at Yale Law School in New Haven, to accept responsibility for what he had done and to more clearly say that he would change his behavior, a little bit like the dialogue between Natan the prophet, Nathan the prophet, and David and Melech, King David, after the whole episode with Bathsheba and her husband. So you're absolutely right. Leaders should be judged not only by their policies, but by their personal behavior.
On a personal note, are you missing being in Washington? What's going on now? Are you kind of like relieved you're not there?
That's a good question. Well, you know, I was really blessed. I mean, 40 years in elective office, 16 here in Connecticut as state senator and attorney general, 24 in the U.S. Senate. So 40 years, I never wanted to, if you will, end my life if I was lucky enough, and yum yum, to go on. But I wanted to end my life in government. I wanted to go on and have another chapter, and I've been lucky enough to do it. Do I miss it occasionally? Sometimes I get up, I hear something, I read something, and I say, oh, I wish I was there. If I was there, I might be able to do something about it. But I can tell you, Rabbi, it passes quickly. I'm involved in a whole bunch of nonprofit organizations that try to encourage more bipartisanship in Washington, that work on foreign policy and education reform. Things like that. So I'm able to keep my my finger and hopefully my head and my heart and my voice involved in some of the debates that I was more directly involved in over those 40 years.
Okay, understood. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Senator Joe Lieberman, who has written a book, With Liberty and Justice, The 50-Day Journey from Egypt to Sinai. So there's got 50 essays over here, and I see that it's divided into different sections, and all the articles, the essays that appear in one section are all of a singular nature. Why, how is it that they came out to be on each individual day? Let me take, for example, today, April, or the 15th day of the Omer, which talks about I've often said this, and I've said it on air over here, as the thing with Dayenu, and why is it that it would have been enough if we'd been to Sinai and did not get the Torah, and it's because the Jews were all there as a singularity. What's that? Yeah. Is there anything significant there between that and the 15th, or they just, by divine providence, just...
No. Actually, what happened is that Rabbi Kahn and I talked about the best way to lay this out. Once we decided we wanted to try to present it in 50 short essays, which could be read either every day of the Omer or at whatever pace anybody wanted, maybe use it at Tikkun on the night of Shavuot, we laid out an outline, and it seemed to me that first we wanted to do some introductory chapters really about my involvement in the law, about the whole idea of debate, respectful, even loving debate in the history of the Jewish people about the law. A few examples of my own involvement in law, such as civil rights law, et cetera. And then we divided it this way. First, in the you might say the preface, the early indications of the importance of values to Hashem and the Torah, going right back to Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, and pivotal moments such as Moses at the burning bush and Avram Avinu and Abraham our father. And then, so it's basically the law before Mount Sinai. And then we have a section about the Ten Commandments and the essays on each of the Ten Commandments. And then the law after Mount Sinai, which in many ways is a combination of the development of rabbinic law, the so-called oral law, and then different applications of law, both in Jewish and secular law. And then a final section on Shavuot with a few things that are a little more humorous than would normally be found in a religious text, which is I have an essay on how did cheesecake become the most popular food on Shavuot. So I'll leave that a mystery for people who buy the book, the answer to that question.
I was actually quite impressed that you put in a section about lawyer jokes and what we can even actually learn from lawyer jokes. Okay, as we know, there's no such thing as...
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. The lawyers become the target of jokes, but in fact, and I laugh at them myself.
Yeah, you know, you said there's no such thing as a good lawyer joke because there's no such thing as a good lawyer. Anyway, yes.
Bada boom. That was good, Rabbi.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so now, when we talk about books that are like Sefirah Companion, we're counting the 49 days, and we have this commandment every night following the evening services. We say today is day one, today is day two, and we go all the way up to day 49. Right. And then the 50th day, we don't count because that has the holiday of Shavuot, the holiday of the Pentecost. You have a 50th essay. Would you say that your 50th essay is what you're working up to? Is this the culmination of the book?
Yeah.
Is an essay?
In many ways. I mean, it's kind of a summary and an evocation to go forward. Of course, this is not a sidur. It's a companion to the Counting of the Omer. So, you know, people can read it on the 50th if they're not. But it has... content to it, and it's kind of a summary. It's sort of a final statement, but really the 49 that preceded, I think each have hopefully significance in their own right as well.
Okay, so it wouldn't be cheating if someone, say, like, read the last essay first or out of order, per se.
No, it wouldn't be cheating, but it doesn't really convey everything that's in the book either.
You
can pick out and read. There's a table of contents, of course, you can take a look at it and start. Actually, it's an interesting point, although the book follows the logical order that I just described, pre-Sinai, post-Sinai, Shavuot. Individual essays, as you see them in the table of contents, can be read if they look interesting to the reader.
Yeah, I'm sure the cheesecake essay is going to be like that. That actually popped out of the page at me is why cheesecake, and it says, "Oh, that's got something to do with morality and ethics." Okay.
In a way, it's the love of sweet. I try to relate it to the sweetness of Torah learning, but you'll see whether I make my case compellingly. I thought the most creative thing I said there was that the answer to why cheesecake is not clear because there's so many potential answers. See, now I'm answering the question, but I said there was a period of time, perhaps because I was a legislator and was so accustomed to having various interest groups come to me and ask for legislation that would, be favorable to that interest group, that I had a fantasy that at one point in Jewish history, an association of Jewish dairy farmers came to the Rebbeim and said, every Yontif and Shabbos is flesh and meat, and can't you give us one holiday on which the focus is on our products, dairy products? And then the Rebbeim said, okay, you can have Shavuos. And so that, of course, is a fantasy.
Right, that's a cute joke. Yes. Okay, so, yes, indeed. Okay, so I just got sidetracked from the next question I was going to ask you. So so our guest has been Senator Joe Lieberman. He's written a compendium thing, With Liberty and Justice, The 50-Day Journey from Egypt to Sinai, in collaboration with Rabbi Ari Kahn. It is published by OU Press and Maggid Press, available wherever Jewish books are sold. Do you have 535 copies earmarked for 535 special individuals, Senator Lieberman?
I don't, but on request, I could make them available. I understand you're talking about the members of Congress.
It's, yes.
It's a lovely idea. Maybe I'll get, see if I can get somebody to do that. And hope that they're interested. I had a lot of interest from my colleagues in the Senate when I wrote the book about Shabbat. So who knows? Hopefully this book will engender interest from people who are obviously. My hope is that more Jews read it and decide to observe Shavuot, even count the Omer. But it's also a book about the necessary role of law, the necessary and constructive role of law in our lives. And I'm basically saying if Bnei Israel, the children of Israel, had just been freed from slavery in Egypt, the result would not have been good. Because if people are just free to do whatever they want with no values encoded in a law, then the result is usually chaos and violence, sometimes even certainly immorality, and perhaps even the self-destruction of the society. So the law really plays an important part. It's one of the, though we joke about lawyers here, it's really one of the great strengths of American society, and I might add of Israel, which is also obviously a rule of law country in every way.
Okay.
Rabbi, I think I have to take leave.
Yes, that's wonderful. We want to thank you so much for coming on, and we wish you continued success in all of your endeavors, Senator Joe Lieberman. Take care.
All the best.
Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
That was our recorded interview with Senator Joe Lieberman, who passed away on March 27th. That interview was recorded on April the 12th, 2020. Our hearts go out to the family, and people always die too young, but, we'll miss him, Joe. He was a good friend. Let's take a commercial break, and we'll be right back.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We are right now getting Rabbi David Shapiro on the line. We have him on. Oh, great. Hello. Hello, are you, Reb David? How are
you? Hello. I'm well, Baruch Hashem.
Good. Thank you so much for taking the time and coming in, hopefully enlightening our listening audience. Okay, so Rabbi David Shapiro, what's a nice Jewish boy like you messing around with astronomy?
Ah, funny you should ask. As a child, I was interested in many different aspects of science and astronomy, and my grandfather got me a telescope, and I read books. And my eyes crossed. I'm reading these books, and I can't figure out how the picture matches what I'm seeing in the sky. And I look in the telescope, and I can't find what I'm supposed to be looking for. And it sort of went by the by. I read about it, but I didn't really care. Fast forward into my 20s, late 20s, and I'm a yeshiva student, and I'm studying the Talmud, and I'm trying to understand something that the Talmud is talking about that has to do with the stars and the planets and the zodiac. And I work on it, and it becomes understandable to me. And I am intrigued by that. And shortly after that, I'm spending Shabbos in the home of a family I know. And we hear a bird singing in the middle of the Friday night meal, and we go outside. And it's a certain kind of bird, and I'm fascinated. And then the lady of the house looks up at the clear night sky and says, oh, look, that's whatever the star was, Betelgeuse. And I look up, I see a lot of stars. I say, which one? That one. How do you know that's Betelgeuse? Well, because that one over there is Antares. And so, what are you talking about? How can you tell one from the other? We went inside, and she gave me a book that was written by the author of Curious George, H.A. Ray, about looking at the stars as if you were a shepherd in Chaldea 3,000 years ago, the way it looks. And he explained the constellations, and he explained everything. And in the back of the book, if you really are a masochist and you want to know the math and the physics, it's all in the back, the way it looks. And suddenly I had a ray of sunlight, although that's not so good for astronomy unless it's an eclipse. I have a ray of sunlight that illuminated my interest, and so it really started with studying the Talmud and finding sort of a window into a subject that had interested me that I never really had a handle on. But my interest grew from there, and I started reading, and I started observing, and I bought a telescope, and I gave classes, and it spiraled upward from there. But that was actually the event that brought me back to my childhood interest in astronomy.
Wonderful. I'm glad we were brought that to the forefront. Okay, so on April 8th, this has become like news across North America that in peak places, the sun will be blotted out for 3.5 minutes, and there are places in Michigan which will hit totality for a grand total of 19 seconds. What's the big deal? Why are people like, and what does Judaism have to say about all this?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of your question?
And what does Judaism have to say about all this?
Okay. So the first question is, why are people making such a big deal? Why do people make a big deal about the Rose Bowl? A bunch of adults are throwing a ball around. What does an ad for the Rose Bowl cost? $10 million for 30 seconds? I have no idea. They make a big deal. People are making money. People are getting excited. It's really a nothing burger. And yet, you could stir up interest in almost anything. However, there is something. I'm not a sports fan, but when you see a guy throwing a ball down the field against tremendous odds, someone catches it and wins the game, you feel a rush of energy, excitement. You're seeing something that not everybody sees. For most of us, the experience of the sun is either during the day, the sun's out. Right now, the sky is blue. There are not too many clouds. The sun's out. It's casting sharp shadows. At night, I don't see the sun. Sunset, it's pretty. Sunrise, also pretty. Dark, I see stars. Daytime, I see the sun. I don't see stars. during an eclipse, during a total eclipse, it's quite interesting because a minute before the totality, the sky looks normal. During totality, the sky gets dark, and you can see the stars in the middle of the day. In fact, not only can you see the stars, I would recommend that your listeners, if they care, take a little time, and I can help with this if you need me to, and find out what constellations and planets are going to be visible on either side of the sun for those couple minutes. I did this a few days ago because I'm giving classes on it. And actually, during those couple minutes of totality, you're going to be able to see potentially Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, the five naked eye planets, all of which are either to the right or left of the sun. And basically, if you visualize, you know, the diagrams of the Copernicus with the sun in the middle and the planets orbiting, you're going to see something that you never see, which is the sun in the middle, momentarily blotted out by the moon. So it's a big dark spot. And over there is Venus, and over there is Mercury, and over there is Mars, over there is Jupiter. You're going to see the solar system right in front of you with the sun in the middle and the planets, you know. And if you would see it an hour later, you'd see Mercury move a little bit. If you see it a month later, you'd see all of them move a lot in circles around the sun. So that's spectacular. Now, most people are going to just look, and they're going to see a semi-dark sky and a bunch of points of light. They won't know what. Yeah, it was actually Arcturus, not Betelgeuse. If there's Arcturus. Anyway, they'll see spots of light in a dusky sky, and it'll be an oddity. But potentially, it's really a window into the work of creation and how things work that a person otherwise would never experience. There are many other things that happen during an eclipse. The animals behave differently. If you're situated on the top of a hill, you can actually see the shadow approaching you from a distance. I did this in Mexico back in, I think it was 1991. I was on the top of the hill. And totality is when the shadow of the moon hits the spot on Earth where you are. Okay, it's now about 2:10 p.m., and the sun is out and the sky is blue. If I would stand outside, the sun would cast a sharp, dark shadow behind me. If I'm facing the sun, behind me is a shadow. If I move, the shadow moves. The sun is shining on the moon, and the moon is casting a shadow. When that shadow hits the Earth, whatever is in that shadow can't see the sun anymore. It's blocked by the moon. And that shadow is moving hundreds of miles an hour. And if you're on a hilltop and you can see, you know, a few miles away in the distance, and you actually see the shadow approaching and sweeping across the valley, and then suddenly you are in totality. It's really cool. It's really amazing. And I enjoyed it. I tried to do it with the eclipse a few years ago, and it was robbed from me because a cloud obscured the sun at the last moment. And although it cleared during totality, but I missed the 5-10 seconds before that of the shadow moving, even though I situated myself on a hilltop with a clear view in the direction of the approaching shadow. Anyway, people get excited. There's another thing that you can see. If you're looking with special glasses, you can see the corona around the sun, which you can never see otherwise because it's too bright. There's all kinds of little bells and whistles and added things. And so if you're with informed people and you have a clear view and people are telling you about it, there's the potential to really enjoy the experience. So that's why everybody's making a big fuss. You still want to know what the Torah says about it?
Yes. This is the Jewish hour. It's not the science hour. So.
The Jewish perspective. So most of what I'm telling you so far, anybody could tell you. What I'm about to tell you, I believe, is an original thought. That doesn't mean it's right or wrong. I'm looking for somebody to concur. When the Torah, when the Bible describes the creation of the universe, day one, day two, day three, day four, on day four, God says there should be ma'orot, sources of light in the firmament of the heavens to illuminate the earth, the great lights to illuminate the day, the less bright, the moon to illuminate the night, together with the stars. And it says that these lights will be for four different purposes. The Hebrew otot, for signs, moadim, seasons, yamim, v'shani, and days, and years. I'm not sure if I have the order right. But the first one is otot, it's signs. The second one is seasons. Now, if I ask you, what do the sun and the moon have to do with days? Well, so, well, when the, you know, when the sun is out, it's day. When the sun is not out, but you can see the moon brightly in the night, that's the night. Okay, I get that. What about years? Well, the solar year, you know, when the moon, when the earth, when the sun hits the vernal equinox every 365 and a quarter days minus a couple minutes, that's a tropical year. There's a lunar year. The Jews and the Muslims count their months by the moon. After 12 lunations, it's a year. For Jewish people, every two or three years, we had a 13th lunation so that the holidays don't slip backwards 11 days a year like it does for the Muslims. For them, Ramadan, you know, it's in the spring, then it's in the winter, then it's in the fall, then it's in the summer. For us, Passover always has to be in the springtime. So if it slips 11 days one year, we advance it 30 days the next year and then slips back another 11 days. Every two or three years, we have 30 days. This is how we keep Passover in the springtime. We have 12 or 13, but those are lunar months. So we make years out of lunar months. So we have days, we have years, moadim, those are the seasons, those are the holidays. Like I just said, that whether the holidays are in this or that, it goes by certain days of a lunar month. But what is the very first one? Osos, signs. What kind of signs? We are taught that when talking to somebody, it's a good idea to try to put the most important thing first and then explain it rather than build up a whole thing and then give the punchline at the end, which I often do. You might lose their interest already. But if you get the interest with the first most important thing, then they're listening to the explanation. The very first reason to have the sun and the moon and the stars is because of Osos signs. What kind of signs? And why is it so important? So the medieval commentary by Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi to most, lived in France in the 11th century. He writes, quoting rabbis who lived before him, that the signs that it's referring to are eclipses, lunar eclipses, solar eclipses, and those are the signs. So a thinking person has to scratch their head and say, wait a minute. There's a universe without a sun and a moon in the sky. There's day and night. I don't know what that is, but there's now you're going to put a sun and the moon in the sky. And besides holidays, besides days, besides years, there's a very important purpose which gets top billing, which is eclipses. Really? A lot of people have never even seen an eclipse, and life goes on. How could eclipses be so important that that is the primary purpose of the sun and the moon? I'm sure you ask this question yourself, reading the Rashi, and what answer did you give? Why are eclipses so important, more important than holidays, more important than days or years?
I've never answered the question. That's why I'm waiting for you. But just to jump in, our guest today is Rabbi David Shapiro. We are talking about the upcoming total eclipse of the sun on April the 8th. And what it means in Judaism. So I'm sure the ancients or people who are less scientifically motivated would have thought that maybe God was angry at the world for that time when suddenly the sun is being taken away from them or something like that. But I don't know if that has any credulity. Even maybe people 3,000 years weren't thinking that. Maybe Jews were smarter and said, oh, that's just an eclipse.
Okay, fair enough. In fact, Rashi does mention, there's a verse in one of the prophets that says, don't be afraid of the signs of the heavens, because it's true. In antiquity, people worshiped the sun. They worshiped the moon.
If the sun can suddenly disappear in broad daylight, you know, the gods are playing tricks. They're doing something crazy. He said, don't be afraid of that. Hashem is running the world. He created it. Don't be confused by the non-Jewish notions of celestial deities. It's not true. Okay? But I would like to offer another explanation that I think goes far deeper.
Go for it.
We live in a scientific age where people on a daily basis using telescopes and various measurements and satellites and all kinds of things, red shifts, blue shifts, redfish, bluefish, the people using science probe the depths of reality, going up into the extreme fringes of the universe and going down into the molecules, into the atoms, into the nucleus, into the quarks, subatomic particles, trying to figure out just exactly what's going on. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for purpose. And the more science people learn, two things happen. They see what incredible organization and purposefulness there seems to be at every level. But also, there's no handle on how this could possibly come to be. How could it be so complicated? How could it be so purposeful? You don't see the hand of God. You don't see a Thomas Edison seeing, and after the thousandth material for a filament, the light bulb goes on and stays on, and he says, aha, tungsten. You know what I mean? You don't see the hand of the creator. You don't see the hand of the inventor. What's going on? And one of the puzzles is life on Earth, because we see there's all these other planets. You know, there's Venus, which is almost the same size as the Earth. It's just a little bit closer to the sun, and it's a furnace. It's hotter on Venus than inside your self-cleaning oven. Okay? And Mars, which is a little bit smaller, but it's, you know, it's bigger than the moon, and it's close to the size of the Earth. It's a little bit further, and it's a freezer, 250 below zero. You don't have life on Venus. You don't have life on Mars. It's like we're in this Goldilocks zone. And then you get closer to the sun, Mercury, farther you get to Jupiter and Saturn and the other gas planets. Forget about it. So we want to know, well, maybe there's life on other planets, in other stars, other galaxies. Yeah, but they have to find the Goldilocks zone. You need a sun this big, and you need an Earth this big at this distance from the sun, you know, and to have life. And, of course, the moon plays a role because of the tides, the tidal forces play an important role in the web of life on this world. Well, any kid who's ever had a microscope, they sit down, they put down a slide, they peer into the thing, they see a bright spot, and they have to move the knob to get it in focus, because the eyepiece you're looking through has to be exactly the right distance. So the focal length of the eyepiece matches what you're looking at, and then, boom, everything comes into focus. And the same thing with a telescope. You have an objective lens on the front, which has a focal length, and you have the eyepiece, and you have to move it back and forth so that the point at which these two lenses focus coincide, and then everything comes into focus. You can see craters on the moon. You can see the rings of Saturn. Otherwise, it's just a blur. I would like to say the reason why eclipses are so important, primary over everything else, is because the fact that the moon, which is basically a rock 2,100 miles in diameter. You know, it fit into the Pacific Ocean very easily, at least, you know, width-wise. And the sun, which is 850,000 miles across, it's more than three times the distance between the Earth and the moon, just across, and 93 million miles away. There's no two objects that we can think of that are more disparate, the moon and the sun. The moon, a tiny rocket, arm's length. The sun, a blazing, fiery ball, very far away, very hard to measure. And yet, our solar system and our eyeballs are set up that the moon takes up exactly the same space in the sky as the sun. And that's a solar eclipse. And when that happens, we suddenly realize that the moon and the sun and the Earth are in exactly the places they need to be for everything else that we know and we care about to exist. If we were any closer or any farther, we would burn or we would freeze. There would be no light. There would be nothing. So every couple of years, we get a little reminder that everything is exactly where it needs to be and how it needs to be for everything else that we take for granted to have reality and to have existence. And that's why I would like to suggest, according to this Rashi, that the word also signs is referring to eclipses, why that's primary, even before holidays, even before day and night. Because if you understand that everything is made with a purpose and incredible wisdom, and you can actually see it with your own eyes, that's the foundation of everything else. And if you're missing that, you could be the greatest scientist and know a million things, and you'll be a horrible person, and you'll ignore your heritage, and you'll do whatever you want, despite your great knowledge.
That's pretty amazing, there, Reb David. So, again, our guest today is Rabbi David Shapiro. We're talking about the upcoming total eclipse of the sun. Is there any significance in Judaism with the fact that this eclipse is occurring on the 29th of Adar, which is the day before Rosh Chodesh, or April 8th, since it is a solar thing happening?
Yes. It's very important to understand. The very first mitzvah in the Torah that was given to the Jewish people is the mitzvah of sanctifying the new moon and dedicating the beginning of the lunar month, because all of our holidays are, almost all of our holidays are determined by so-and-so many days of whichever month. Rosh Hashanah, first day of the seventh month. Yom Kippur, 10th day of the etc. Well, for that to make sense, you have to know what's the first day of the month, so you can know to start counting. So how is that determined? Well, the moon in its orbit, apparent orbit around the Earth, there's different phases of the moon. After 2 weeks into the month, the moon is full. The sun is setting in the west, the moon is rising in the east, and it's full. A week later, it only rises at midnight, and it's half there. A week after that, you can't even see the moon, because it's so close to the sun that it's lost in the glare of the sun. When it reemerges after that on the other side of the sun, in the evening sky again, a tiny little crescent, that's Rosh Chodesh, that's the beginning of the new month. In antiquity, the mitzvah of determining Rosh Chodesh was a relatively simple affair, because the moon goes by the sun. It laps the sun as it's going around the earth every 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, and 3 1/3 seconds on average, sometimes more, sometimes less, approximately 29 and a half days. So on the 30th day, I might see the moon again, or I might not. But if I'm counting and I'm calculating, I'll know in advance whether I can expect it. A solar eclipse only occurs at the moment that the moon is lapping the sun. That's why it's blocking the light of the sun. And so that is what in Jewish traditional terms is called the molad, the moment from which the birth of the new moon is counted. And then it takes a certain number of hours for the moon to continue and get far enough away from the sun, so by the time the sun sets, you can see the crescent, etc. These are calculations easily made. But the starting point is when the moon laps the sun. Now, most of the time, it's a number. We can't see it. At a lunar eclipse, we can actually see that. I mean, a solar eclipse. So every solar eclipse, by definition, is going to occur the day before the new moon, because that's really what's going on. Now, you might not see it that night. You might not see it till the following night. But that is really what's going on. So it's not an accident. It's not a coincidence. It's particularly cool that it's happening on Erev Rosh Chodesh Nisan, because Nisan is not only the first of the months of the year, but when the Torah tells us that it's the first of the months of the year, Moshe is told, "Achodesh hazeh lechem Rosh Chodeshim," that the renewal of the moon like this will be the beginning of months, and this particular month will be the first of the months of the year. So that mitzvah that the Jewish people were given to determine the months by observing the moon actually took place that month, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. But when we are physically experiencing this eclipse from which we can determine exactly when Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, should be, which happens to be exactly what was going on 2,440 whatever years ago. Okay? It's a while ago. It happened. Excuse me. 3,330 going on 6 years ago. Yeah, when the Jews stood on Mount Sinai and this was all going on. So any eclipse, any solar eclipse will be the day before Rosh Chodesh, the new moon, because of what I just told you. And this particular one happens to be exactly before the first of the months of the year when we were taught this particular law.
Wonderful.
So it's very cool and very appropriate.
Okay. Do you happen to know on top of your head when the next one's going to be after this one?
Not on the top of my head. I could look it up and let you know, I can't.
Okay, very good. Okay, all right, that's going to wrap it up for us, Reb David. We want to thank you so much. Our
thank
guest today
you.
Has been David Shapiro, a rabbi and astronomer extraordinaire. Thank you so much for coming on. And where will you be for the total eclipse of the sun on April 8th?
I've been invited to join a group of people who I accompanied in the last eclipse. What was that, 2017? We drove all the way to Tennessee to see that eclipse. Hopefully, we don't have to go that far. The eclipse is coming. You said in Michigan. I don't know any place in Michigan, but it's close to Michigan. Maybe down right near Toledo. Yeah, you're right. Luna Pier, very well named.
Seconds.
Luna Pier, right? That's where you can see the moon getting in front of the sun.
Right.
So, So in the couple of days before the eclipse, I'll be looking at weather patterns and determining where the best place to see it from that I can get to in the time of portion. So
yeah, it's probably be Dallas,
answer.
But yeah.
Hopefully not Dallas. Some Interstate 90 through Ohio, going up the shore of Lake Ontario, up past Buffalo, up to Canada, goes right in the path of totality. So you just stay on there going to the northeast, and as long as you could drive 1,000 miles an hour, no problem.
There you go. Okay, thank you, Reb.
Thank you.
That's going to do it. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're looking at the Jewish Hour. With the new year approaching, why go anywhere else for your holiday shopping when you can go to The Grove? Fully renovated, The Grove is located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696. At The Grove, you'll find the largest selection of kosher foods and wines in Michigan. Looking for fresh, round holiday challahs, honey cake, or exotic fruit for the new year? The Grove has it. The Grove has the freshest produce, gourmet dairy, deli, and meats. They even have a kosher bakery and hot takeout right on the premises. It's The Grove on Greenfield Road and 696 for all your shopping needs. The Grove is in full swing for Passover. They've got everything that you could possibly think of for all your Passover needs. Check them out. They're on Greenfield Road just south of 696. You take the Greenfield Road exit and you go south, and it's right next to the bank building over there. It's a parking lot, the second drive after that, and you're in. And tell them you heard it on the Jewish Hour. They'll appreciate it. Want to get in touch with me? Best way, rabbifinman.com. We have ways of getting in touch with me right up there on the homepage. We also have archived editions of the radio show and other things that we do. Just as a reminder, if you're listening to this show before Sunday, March the 31st, so at March 31st at 7 o'clock, we will be having Rabbi David Shapiro. We'll be coming to Jewish Ferndale, 1725 Pinecrest Drive in Ferndale, Michigan. And we'll be talking an expanded talk of what you heard today. This is just the tip of the sunberg, as the case may be. And it's at 7 o'clock. It's free and comes with a cup of tea. So that's all the refreshments we're giving because we're getting ready for Passover, which Passover is the 22nd through the 30th, and we will be posting an entire week's worth of events, including Seders and Mashiach Sudas and Friday nights. And you get in touch with me with all of that. You could also we need donations. Passover is coming up and it's big expenses coming up. So go to the donations page and give a donation. And I want to tell this story. That's why I'm hurrying up. This story, the Maggid of Kozhnitz, who is a student of Elimelech Lishansk, said that if you tell these three stories before Passover, you'll be guaranteed to have enough money for Passover. So I'm going to tell story number one this week, and we'll see what happens in the ensuing weeks. There was a person who lived in Lishansk who was a liquor smuggler. And I don't know if he was bringing in single malt, what he was bringing in over there, which is very interesting because the Russians, they just made their own stuff and the peasants drank. It didn't matter what it was that they were drinking, just as long as they got drunk. But he would bring in stuff. And one day he's bringing in stuff and he got stopped by the border and they confiscated the whole load. And he's like devastated. He doesn't have a margin on this stuff. He's got bills to pay. So he ran right away to Eli Melech of Lizhansk and said, "What do I do?" I said, "I had to borrow money to buy that liquor. And now I can't pay the people back. And on top of that, I don't have any money to pay my bills." The rabbi told him, "Go back and say that the barrels are filled with water." He said, "Really?" He said, "Go back and tell them they're filled with water." So he went back to the customs and said, "I'm sorry, you've made a mistake. The barrels are filled with water." And they said, "Come on, it says alcohol on the outside of the barrel." He said, "Taste it." So they got a spigot, they opened it up, spring water. Every barrel, spring water. So they let it go through. Now he's got a problem. He's got all his money and all he's got in it is water, which back then they didn't have to worry about what kind of quality there was. Water was water. So he goes running back to Eli Melech Lizhansk and says, "I've got water. What am I going to do?" He said, "It's not water. Go taste it." So he said, "It was what? Go taste it." So he went and he opened it up and he tasted it. He said, "It was the best alcohol he's ever had in his life." That's the story. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you had a great week. Hope to see you back next week. Take care.